TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. This is the second part of a one-hour program with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. She grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She holds a PhD in history and is an activist in the international indigenous movement. Her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, was published to high acclaim in the fall of 2014, in part rewriting the official history of the U.S. Dunbar Ortiz is looking for reasons why the founding ideology of the U.S. proved so deadly for the indigenous peoples living here. She explains how the early settlers considered themselves to be the chosen people and claimed a covenant with God that is later expressed in the U.S. Constitution. A little known and astounding fact is that to this day, the U.S. follows the doctrine of discovery developed by the Pope for Portugal and Spain, and then used by the modern colonial powers. The doctrine of discovery treats indigenous land as unoccupied and ready for the taking as long as Christians were not present. Even the status and definition of a human was based on religion. The U.S. Supreme Court, as recently as 2005, relied on the doctrine of discovery to limit the sovereignty of the Oneida Nation. Here's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz with a brief reading from the chapter on the Cult of the Covenant.
Although the U.S. Constitution represents for many U.S. citizens a covenant with God, the U.S. origin story goes back to the Mayflower Compact, the first governing document of the Plymouth Colony, named for the ship that carried the 100 or so passengers to what is now Cape Cod, Massachusetts, in November 1620. 41 of the so-called pilgrims, all men, and they were Calvinists, of course, wrote and signed the compact. Invoking God's name and declaring themselves loyal subjects of the king, the signatories announced that they had journeyed to Northern Virginia, as the eastern seaboard of North America was called by the English, to plant the first colony, and did therefore covenant and combine ourselves together in a civil body politic to be governed by just and equal laws enacted for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. The original settlers of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, founded in 1630, adopted an official seal designed in England before their journey. The central image depicts a near-naked native holding a harmless, flimsy bow and arrow and inscribed with a plea, "Come over and help us." Nearly 300 years later, the official seal of the U.S. military veterans of the Spanish-American War, that is the invasion, occupation of Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines, showed a naked woman kneeling before an armed U.S. soldier and a sailor with a U.S. battleship in the background. One may trace this recurrent altruistic theme into the early 21st century, when the United States still invades countries under the guise of rescue. In other modern constitutional states, constitutions come and go, and they're never considered sacred in the manner patriotic U.S. citizens venerate theirs. Great Britain has no written constitution, so they didn't get it from the British. The Magna Carta arguably comes close, but it does not reflect a covenant. The U.S. Constitution, the Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, the writings of the so-called Founding Fathers, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the Pledge of Allegiance, which was written in the 1880s, and even Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, are all bundled into the covenant as sacred documents that express the U.S. state religion. An aspect of this most visible in the early 21st century is the burgeoning gun lobby, based on the sanctity of the Second Amendment to the Constitution. In the forefront of the Second Amendment adherents are the descendants of the old settlers who say that they represent the people and have the right to bear arms in order to overthrow any government that does not, in their view, adhere to the God-given covenant. From its beginning, the United States has welcomed, indeed even often solicited and even bribed, immigrants to repopulate conquered territories cleansed of their indigenous inhabitants. From the mid-19th century, immigrants were recruited to work mines, raise forests, construct canals and railroads, and labor in sweatshops, factories, and commercial farm fields. In the late 20th century, technical and medical workers were recruited. Their requirements for formal citizenship were simple, and are simple now. Adhere to the sacred covenant through taking the citizenship oath, pledging loyalty to the flag, and regarding those outside the covenant as enemies or potential enemies of the exceptional country that has adopted them, often after they have escaped hunger, war, or repression, which in turn were often caused by U.S. militarism or economic sanctions. Yet no matter how much immigrants might strive to prove themselves to be as hardworking and patriotic as descendants of the original settlers, and despite the rhetoric of "we are all one people," they are suspect. The old stock against which they are judged inferior includes not only those who fought in the 15-year war for independence from Britain, but also, and perhaps more important, those who fought and shed Indian blood before and after independence in order to acquire the land. These are the descendants of the English Pilgrims, Scots, Scots-Irish, and Huguenot French, Calvinists all, who took the land bequeathed to them in the Sacred Covenant that predated the creation of the independent United States. So the land won through North American bloodshed was not necessarily conceived in terms of particular parcels for a farm that would be passed down through generations. Most of the settlers who fought for it kept moving on nearly every generation. In the South, many lost their holdings to land companies that then sold it to planters seeking to increase the size of their slave-worked plantations. Without the unpaid forced labor of enslaved Africans, a farmer growing cash crops could not compete on the market. Once in the hands of settlers, the land itself was no longer sacred, as it had been for the indigenous. Rather, it was private property, a commodity to be acquired and sold, every man a possible king, or at least wealthy. Later, when Anglo-Americans had occupied the continent or urbanized much of it, this quest for land and the sanctity of private property were reduced to a lot with a house on it, and the land came to mean the country, the flag, the military, as in the land of the free, of the national anthem, or Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land." Those who died fighting in foreign wars were said to have sacrificed their lives to protect this land that the old settlers had spilled blood to acquire. The blood spilled was largely indigenous. These then were the settlers upon which the national myths are based, the ultimately dispensable cannon fodder for the taking of the land and the continent. They were not of the ruling class, although a few slipped through and later were drawn in by the ruling class as elected officials and military officers, thereby maintaining the facade of a classless society and a democratic empire. The founders themselves and the elite were English patricians, slave owners, large land barons, or otherwise successful businessmen dependent on the slave trade and exports produced by enslaved Africans and on property sales. When descendants of the settler class, overwhelmingly Presbyterian or otherwise Calvinist Protestant, were accepted into the ruling class, they almost always became Episcopalians, members of an elite church linked to the State Church of England. As we look at the bloody deeds of the settlers in acquiring and maintaining land, the social class context is an essential element.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz reading from the chapter on the Cult of the Covenant from her 2014 book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. A person in the audience asked about the role of the military in the suppression and re-education of Native peoples, and why so many Indians enlist in the military.
That's colonialism. There's still a colonial condition. All of the laws of the United States put in place, its brand of colonialism, each colonialism is a little bit different. It was first put within the Department of War, and it was militarily organized. These concentration camps surrounded by the military, and they became then civilianized, going to the Department of Interior, but with the same legal basis and the doctrine of discovery, you know, that colonial instrument used. The Vatican proclaimed in 1454 for the Portuguese to invade and enslave the people of West Africa for the begin launching of the slave trade. Then after Columbus' voyage for the Spanish monarchs, another papal bull in 1494 included Spain in this doctrine of discovery. And then all the other colonizing powers adopted it as their legal basis. This is the first Western international law, was the doctrine of discovery. The United States is the only country in the world that still codifies the doctrine of discovery. Supreme Court decisions in the 1820s that codified it are still in effect and are the colonial institutions that control. Now, that along with the boarding schools, which were begun, some of them in the 1830s, by different churches that were given contracts to be, you know, the on-site colonizers of some of the people east of the Mississippi, especially among the Seneca, the Iroquois in upstate New York. But then in the 1870s were introduced as federal boarding schools. They still had some religious ones always, farmed out contract. But they all behaved in the same way as a very regimented military style. At first they were just boys, and later they took girls. But in both cases they were extremely militarized. Native people were forced. They would send soldiers to take the children if people didn't turn the children in to be transported, sometimes way across the country. At first, there was only one in Pennsylvania, so people were being transported a long ways from west of the Mississippi. And then over 200 of them were established. Right now, there's a whole boarding school project to gather the testimony of this kind of generational trauma caused by being taken away from your family for 10 years. De-Indianized completely, haircut, no religious or cultural aspects to linger. And worst of all, just horrible abuse. They put different tribes together, and English was the only language allowed. They would be beaten for speaking their own language. So you have generations of people traumatized this way. Native people who have federal recognition have never been subject to the draft, to conscription, but they have always enlisted, volunteered in percentages greater than any other ethnic group. And a part of this is that it's encouraged, you know, it was encouraged in the boarding schools to go straight then into the army. go fight in the Philippines, go fight in the European wars.
That was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States. The next question was about an earlier book by her, The Great Sioux Nation, published in 1977, came out of the 1974 Wounded Knee Trials, where Dunbar Ortiz was an expert witness. In 1973, the American Indian Movement had been asked by Lakota elders to come to the Pine Ridge Reservation to help protect them from the death squads of a corrupt tribal leader, Richard Wilson. They had tried to democratically impeach Wilson, but failed because he had the protection of the U.S. government. In February 1973, AIM and Lakota began an armed takeover of Wounded Knee in memory of the 1890 massacre of Wounded Knee of Lakota women, children, and elders. The occupation resulted in a 71-day siege by federal forces that encircled them. During the siege, federal officers and AIM members exchanged gunfire almost nightly. Hundreds of arrests were made, and two Native Americans were killed, and a federal marshal was permanently paralyzed. The leaders of AIM finally surrendered on May 8, after a negotiated settlement was reached. U.S. District Judge Warren K. Urbaum presided over the trials of Native activists in 1974. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz acted as expert witness. Here's her remembrance.
The Great Sioux Nation was my first book in 1977, and it came out of the Wounded Knee Trials. All of the people who came out of Wounded Knee were arrested and charged with various felonies and misdemeanors. So it just tied the movement up. Each one after another, were dismissed, or the people found not guilty. A few people served some jail time. It was just kind of purposely putting the American Indian Movement to great expense, raising money for court cases and not being able to organize in the communities. So we decided to have these remaining cases, I think there were about 90 of them left, that they all be dismissed on the basis of this treaty that said that any crimes committed in the Great Sioux Nation, the people were subject to punishment by Sioux authorities. And this was when the Great Sioux Nation was a contiguous land base that covered all of North and South Dakota, or some of Wyoming and Montana, and much of Nebraska. And that had, you know, has been broken down into seven separate little reservations within that. The largest amount of that land taken away when the Black Hills were the sacred area of the Sioux were taken illegally. And that was actually because of AIM and Wounded Knee and the Sioux Treaty hearing in 1980, the Supreme Court accepted a case and found that the Black Hills were taken illegally. But the federal government only pays money compensation, not restoration of land. So the Sioux refused to take the money, and now it's up to something like almost $2 billion in a trust fund that the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere refused to take because they want the land back. So that's still a struggle going on. And that was one of the reasons for the Wounded Knee occupation, one of the demands, and in general, that the United States should honor that treaty. So this hearing that was held in Lincoln, Nebraska in December 1974
was just about this time of year. I was an expert witness and also on the legal team with Vine Deloria and, you know, a bunch of other lawyers. We decided to, or the people decided to insist that the judge allow this oral history to be told by the elder Sioux people. Some of them medicine people, some of them traditional chiefs. So we had 2 weeks of hearings, and the judge allowed that. He allowed swearing on the medicine bag instead of the Bible. It was just became a native courtroom, you know. Was even though the motion was denied on the basis that that it was only Congress that could make such a decision on a treaty, because it was Congress that approved treaties, he did make the statement, the judge, that they should take it to international. So that's exactly what they did right after that. Took it as a centerpiece to the United Nations. And that was the beginning of the UN work. So at the end of the hearing, I was surrounded by several of the elder people, and I had done a lot of testimony and a lot of work and a lot of expert witness testimony. It was not my specialization. The Southwest and Oklahoma was my specialization in history, and, you know, and historians really stick with their specializations, you know. Well, that didn't last long, because they asked me to work this up, all this testimony from the court records, into a book. I said, we think you could do this because you're a historian. And they liked my testimony. They trusted me. And I said, tried to get out of it. And there's no way you could say no to that. So for the next 3 years, I worked on that book, and it was published in 1977. And I got the 5,000-page court reporters' records. You know, they sit there and they type. They're pretty amazing, you know, how they can. But they didn't have problems with the ones who used, the Lakotas who used a translator. There was a very good Lakota bilingual man there, but some of these elders didn't speak English. So he was very clear in his translation, so she didn't have any problem with that. But the old medicine man, Henry Crow Dog, he insisted on speaking English because he thought he wanted to express it exactly like he wanted to. When I was listening to him talk, I understood every word. I was even taking some notes. It was so brilliant. And he spoke almost nonstop for about 2 hours. But when I got the court records, it was just gibberish. She couldn't make out what he was saying. And I realized I was listening to it as, because I had learned to, you know, kind of understand his interesting English. And he used to, because he had been forced to, in boarding school, to read the Bible and everything. So he used a lot of language from Revelations, and me being raised a Southern Baptist, I was familiar, you know, with those images of Revelations. And he was predicting apocalypse for the United States. And there's nothing better than Revelations for scary apocalypse. So it was clear to me, but she phonetically spelled everything he said. But in written form, this was, you know, was not English, it was not anything. I did know that that was the most important testimony. And then I met Simon Ortiz, who's a poet from Acoma Pueblo. And I showed it to him, and I told him the story about Henry Crow Dog's testimony and how it's just essential. I just felt like he had summarized You know, he gave a summary of all 2 weeks. And you would have thought he slept the whole time. He had his eyes closed, looking like he was dozing the whole time for 2 weeks. But when he spoke, he was summarizing everything. And it was just brilliant. So Simon started looking at it, and he got at his typewriter and started typing it and putting it in poetry form. And then he could make out what the words were that she had spelled phonetically, what she heard, but could guess at it. So he was able to translate it, and we then checked it with Henry and with Severt Young Bear, the translator, to make sure this was his, these were his intention. So that's in the book, and I divided it up because he was summarizing, and I divided it up into different parts of the book as the beginning of each chapter. So it's a really, really interesting book. One of these days I plan to make some kind of website where I'll put all of, the whole court proceedings up, because it is an interesting process. So thank you for asking about the Great Sioux Nation.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, author of the 2014 Beacon Press book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. I recorded her on December 4, 2014 at Green Apple, one of the last used bookstores in San Francisco. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was the fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indigenous Peoples of the Americas. That conference was held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a part Indian mother and a tenant farmer. After receiving her PhD in history at the University of California, Los Angeles, she taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at Cal State Hayward and helped found the departments of Ethnic and Women's Studies there. Dunbar-Ortiz is the author or editor of 7 other books, including Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie, and Blood on the Border, Memoir of the Contra War. She lives in San Francisco. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.